And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. This is Martin Willis, your host. And I am back from Russia. That was way too long to be over there. It feels really, really good to be home. We are very lucky to live in the country that we live in. And also, just to let you know, that intro, I'm going to have to change that because it says we're live on the Dark Matter Digital Network. I don't know where I found that intro, but that's an old one. We are not. But however, if you can't support our show and you'd like to listen to full shows, we are still on the Dark Matter Digital Network. And that's every Thursday evening. It's like a podcast, a two-hour podcast, every Thursday evening from 10 to midnight. You can catch it there. You can always catch our shows live for free, the full show. That's either on YouTube, on our YouTube channel. You can subscribe to that. Or on podcastufo.com. And that's every Wednesday at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Also, the Everything Else show. I did a show last Monday with Nick Redfern. We talked about his theory on Roswell, which is entirely different than I think most of us have heard. And also we talked about cryptid animals and maybe kind of like the paranormal side of what his thoughts were on that. Why no one has ever found a Bigfoot? Why no one has ever found any of these others that countless people say they see? No evidence. Why is that? So that's what we talk about. Now, that if you're a subscriber to the show, that comes out as a podcast, and that will be coming out on Saturday. So you can listen to those shows on either Monday, or if you're a subscriber, you can listen to the show in your media player for free. Speaking of supporters, I did the statistics. About 3.5% of our listeners support the show. So I want to say thank you very, very much for that 3.5% that helps us out. That does pay the bills. And it's really nice to have that. We do get a lot of downloads, use a lot of bandwidth, dedicated server and all that. Our guest this evening is Mark O'Connell, and he's going to be talking about his book on Dr. J. Allen Hynek. Very interesting man. And before that, Alejandro Rojas could not make the UFO updates. He double booked himself, according to him, or he's playing hooky. So he's not going to be on this week. He'll be back next week. Instead, I have Mick West. Now, Mick has been on the show a couple of times, and I really respect his work, his very thorough work. He has metabunk.org, and we're going to be talking about the Nazca three-fingered alien, and there's more, these mummies. That's what we're going to be talking about, and what his research and how he uncovered the most likely thought is that these are some type of hoax, whether a recent hoax or an early hoax, but that's kind of what it boils down to, so we're going to be talking about that. And welcome to the show. How are you, Mick?
Good. Good. How are you doing, bud?
Great. So, first of all, how do you find all these things? I mean, you do one or two things a week that you dive into and try to find, you know, explanations for what they really are. So how do you find all these things to take a look at and dive deep into what they are?
Well, you know, I've been doing it for a while, so I think Facebook knows the type of thing that I like, so I get up the type of thing showing up on my Facebook feed. But I also have a Google filter set for weird news and UFOs, and every time a story pops up in the media, it just emails me with the story, and I give it a quick look to see if it's interesting, and if it is, I might delve into it a little bit
more. Now, the last time we had you on, you were talking about the Chilean UFO, and you basically kind of broke the story of what that really was. Now, the entire, you know, Chilean government was behind that as being a UFO, and you found all the data when the plane was exactly where the plane was, the course of it, and everything lined up perfectly. That changed that whole story.
Yeah, it was a team effort, really. There was other people on Metabank who helped. But yeah, we've done that type of thing before, like tracking down a plane. And I think once we realized that it was probably a commercial jet and we were able to track down the traffic for the area, it was actually fairly straightforward.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've basically done a lot of that before with the whole chemtrail stuff that I look into.
Right,
a lot.
Right. I know that's another one out there that you hear a lot about. And basically, since we're just touching on that subject real quickly, there's no evidence that there is such a thing as chemtrails. Everybody says they're spraying things for climate control or to control people and all that. There's never any solid evidence to anything like that, is there?
Not that I've come across. I mean, people bring up a lot of things. I mean, the most common thing that people bring up is the idea that the trails shouldn't persist. But I've got like a whole bookshelf over there filled of books on the weather that explain that contrails do persist, and they have done ever since planes were invented. So the basic premise of the theory is flawed, and everything else is just kind of follows on from there.
Doesn't it really have to do with altitude as well, with them hanging around?
It does, yes. It has to do with temperature, which, of course, you know, as you get higher, it gets colder.
Yeah.
So when you're up at 35,000 feet, the temperature is usually 40 below or colder.
Right.
And at that temperature, the exhaust basically condenses and freezes instantly and creates a contrail, which is really just a type of cloud. It's not really anything special. It's not like a smoke plume or anything. It's just a cloud triggered by the exhaust of the jet.
You know, speaking of the altitude and temperature, I had Nick Redfern on my show on Monday, and we were talking about high-altitude balloons, and he said, you know, the higher they go, sometimes they'll burst because of the heat of the sun. And I thought about it afterwards. You know, I know that outside of a plane is, you know, well below zero. So that's not really the case, is it? Once a high-altitude balloon keeps going higher, it doesn't get hotter, does it?
No, it doesn't really. They burst because of the reduction
right.
in pressure.
Yeah.
Basically, like they'll just keep going up until the gas inside of them will expand.
Yeah.
And weather balloons, for example, are designed so that the balloon will burst at a certain altitude, and then the package, the radio sonde at the bottom, will return back to Earth.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not really being heated up by the sun. Although if you get really, really high, then the air is too thin to actually take away the heat in the form of cold. So it kind of works the other way around. As you get a lot higher, there's a thing called the thermopause, where things actually get warmer as you get higher. But generally, they get
colder.
Wow,
how about that? Now, what is your background? Do you have a science background, or is it just a passion study of yours?
No, I don't really have a science background. My degree is in computer science.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I don't really consider a science myself, but there's a science on my degree. But I when I was young, I read a lot of science books, and now since I've been doing Metabunk and contrail science, contrail science has been going for about 10 years now. I've just had a lot of exposure to these types of things and investigating this type of thing. And I use the stuff from my background as a video game programmer, where I do lots of 3D. Geometry calculations for the video graphics.
I see.
And it all just kind of comes together, and it's just what I do now, and so I'm kind of got good at it after a while.
Okay, so let's talk about the claims. First of all, we know Jaime Mosain is involved in this, and how do you say it? Is it Gaia? Do you know how that's pronounced?
Yeah Gaia.
So they're involved in this. So and also, I read somewhere online that there's a symposium they're trying to put together where $350 per ticket and that type of stuff. I couldn't find out any date or anything when that's supposed to happen. But what was your conclusions on to what these things are? Now, there's more of them that have been rolling out. One that looks like it looks like it has eggs inside of it and stuff like that.
Right.
So let's talk about where this led you and what your conclusions were.
Well, the first one I looked at was the large specimen, which came out in that Gaia video, which is kind of it's curled into a fetal mm-hmm. position. It looks odd because it has these three-fingered hands and three-toed feet, and it has this strange-looking face. But when they actually show the X-rays of it, that's kind of what made me suspect what it actually was. Because if you look at the X-rays of the mummy, you'll see that the bones in the hand look exactly like the middle three bones of a human hand, but with the little finger and the thumb removed. Now, there's a bunch of bones down here called the metacarpals, mm-hmm. Or the carpals are the ones at the bottom. These are the metacarpals. And it looks like all that they did is they removed the little finger, they removed the thumb, and then they split the hand down here. And if you compare what a human skeleton would look like if you did that to the X-rays that they provide of the mummy, it would look exactly the same. So it really looks like it's just a human skeleton that's been modified to look unusual.
Do you think now there's speculation that that this is very possible that this and I know that they modified some of these mummies with animal bones and things like that. This is human bones, but do you think this was done a long time ago, or any ideas on when it was done?
You see, that's the thing that's kind of very difficult to say. They say they've done carbon dating on it, which dates it back like 1,000 years or so. But that obviously only dates the actual material of the mummy. We don't know if the entire thing dates back 1,000 years. They could have actually put it together from other bits and pieces of things that were actually mummified 1,000 years ago. Now, there is a possibility that it was actually created by the native people 1,000 years ago. Perhaps for some reason they were making strange-looking mummies out of their dead people. There's been suggestions that they were visited by aliens and then they were trying to make their dead look like these aliens so that they would be more like the gods as they would see them and, go up to join the gods. But, there's really nothing to go by because no one's actually looked at the archaeological site where these specimens have supposedly come from. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing archaeology, really the first thing and the most important thing is to actually secure and examine the site so you get mm-hmm. a very solid record of exactly where these objects come from. And you see them picking up these mummified hands and waving them around like they're nothing. They don't seem to be really taking the whole thing very seriously.
Now, isn't it difficult to get permission to actually go into these places and actually remove, archaeological?
Oh yeah, no. They have the Ministry of Antiquities or whatever it's called in Peru. But yeah, they're not supposed to be doing it. the official channels are supposed to do it. So there's some debate in Peru about exactly what's been going on and have they broken the law or is there any evidence that they've done that. But if no one can actually prove that they took these things from anywhere, then the authorities can't really prove that they have taken them from anywhere. But that in itself implies that they were faked. But really, the important thing here would be seeing the archaeological mm-hmm. site. Another thing, obviously, would be taking some DNA samples of the bones and seeing what they're actually made from.
Right, right. Now, as far as the cranial formation, that was nothing really that uncommon. I mean, they used to shape, baby from infancy, used to shape their heads.
They still do in some mm-hmm. places, and you can also occasionally get natural deformations of human skulls that turn out like that. But, cranial modification of much more extreme forms. We've seen that with the very long kind of cone head type shapes in some cultures. So that in itself isn't really suspicious. One thing that looks odd with the mummy is the eyes. But the thing about that is that they don't really show up like that on the skeleton. You can see that those eyes and those eye slits appear to have just been formed manually by some kind of clay or something on the front of the face.
Uh-huh. And the white, at first they thought the white was like a plaster, which it is not. It's something else that it's probably some type of like oxidation. It's very dry there.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what it is, but it's not plaster.
They say in one of the videos that it was Diamaticus earth, which is it's a common material that you can buy at a gardening supply store, used for like a type of fertilizer, essentially, or a bug killer. And it's a desiccant. It's a thing that makes things dry.
Oh.
So if the white stuff is Diamaticus earth, that would be something where you could figure out where that actually came from, because it may well be that region, Cusco, is very high. Cusco is at like 13,000 feet, so I don't know if they're going to have Diamaticus earth, because that's the remains of seashells. So I don't know if they would have a source of that. It sounds, the fact that it is that sounds kind of modern to me.
And it's very bright. You know, whether that, when they first said it, someone said it was plaster. I said that, you know, I, from my personal experience as an appraiser, know that plaster always yellows over time. You know, it doesn't stay bright like that.
Yeah. Yeah, this is essentially, it's calcified sea creatures, tiny little diatoms.
Kind of like meerschaum. I don't know if you know what meerschaum is. Yeah.
I don't know.
They actually make pipes and carvings out of it. It's, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Now, the thing that got me right off the bat when I first saw this, someone sent me the original video, and right off the bat is the alien. You know, why do they have to throw the alien tag on this thing right off the bat? I mean, they are discovering human, different types of human-type skeletons. They always have. And so why right off the bat say it's alien? I mean...
Yeah, and if you saw the article I wrote on it, I made a list of, I think, like seven different things it could possibly be. And you do from the most probable thing to the least probable thing. And alien seems to be pretty much the least likely thing that it would be. And various types of fake or natural occurrence are more possible things. Like, you know, it could be a previously undiscovered animal, like some kind of ape or something like that. But that in itself is very unlikely. That's something you could prove very quickly by doing some DNA testing, which they haven't done.
Happen to know if that is something they're going to be doing and revealing before they have the symposium, or are they going to?
I don't know what their plans are. You know, if I was to guess at what their plans are, I think they're going to try to draw this out as long as they can, and they will eventually say that it is, you know, some kind of composite thing, either a human skeleton or the smaller ones will be human skeletons, bones mixed with animal bones. And I think that's eventually where they're going to get, that it was made to look in the image of aliens. So they've still got that kind of connection, and it's still kind of an interesting thing. But I don't think they're going to be able to keep up the idea that these are actual alien remains indefinitely.
Right. Well, hey, Mick, thanks so much. And, I think you were on, the very first time you were on is when someone was saying they were spotting a triangle UFO on the moon. And you figured that out exactly what that was. Had nothing, it just had to do with the way the images were pieced together. Right? If I remember right. Yeah.
That's right.
All right. Thanks so much. And everyone, it's...
it was just an image of pixels.
Right. All right, so this is Mick West, and he's from Metabunk. It's spelled just the way it sounds, metabunk.org. Check out his website, and he has uncovered a lot. He is the friendly debunker, okay? So a lot of debunkers have a bad name, but he's the friendly debunker. Thanks a lot, Mick. All right,
thank you.
Take care.
You.
Bye-bye. All right, so let me see. Mick, you're going to have to hang up if you would. I can't do that separately from our guest. So our guest, Our guest.
Good talking to you.
Here we are. Our guest is Mark O'Connell. Mark has been on the show before. And actually, when he was on the show last time, he did bring up the fact that he was writing a book on Dr. J. Allen Hynek. And he did. And it's a great book. I've heard a couple of interviews. I have not read the book. I hope to. And that's the thing. A lot of people ask. I had someone ask in the last show, basically, why aren't you reading the books? Well, I have a full-time career as well as doing this show. I love to read, but I can't read books like George Knapp can read a book in a day. It takes me a long time to read a book. I'm not like that. So anyway, I'm here with Mark O'Connell. How are you, Mark?
I am great, Martin. Thanks for having me here.
And I think you were on the show just before you started writing the book, if I got that right.
I'm a little foggy on when that was. The last couple of years of my life have been so full of research for the book that my timetables sort of get compressed screwed up.
Well, you were on. I remembered that. I think I connected you with Ray Stanford because Ray knew Dr. Hynek.
Mm. Yes. That. Yeah. Okay. Then that does go back probably at least 3 years.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Right.
Does that
I think
sound
that's
right
about
to
right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It would have to be that far
right.
back.
Right. So, how is the book doing?
It's doing pretty well. We're having steady sales. Just publishing world is all new to me. The professional writing I've done in the past has generally been for the screen, TV, and movie scripts, and that world moves at a. It seems slow when you're. You're in it, but compared to publishing, it's pretty fast. Publishing is things move very slowly in publishing. I'm learning. You have to measure things in weeks, and I'm just doing a lot of media appearances still, and doing a lot of social media, and just enjoying the hell out of this whole book promotion.
Wow,
tour.
That's great. And now, when you wrote the book, hang on, let me just fix something here. When you wrote the book. Well, I should put it this way. What made you decide to write about Hynek himself?
I didn't really decide it. The opportunity kind of fell into my lap. I'm sure the last time I did your show, I talked about my blog, High Strangeness, highstrangenessufo.com. I started that about 5 years ago and was always looking for new material to write about. And sort of stumbled across a website for the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. Well, I was living in Chicago at the time and thought, hey, I need to pay these guys a visit. So I got a hold of Mark Rodiger, who is the scientific director of KUFOS. So I should add, KUFOS is the UFO research organization founded by J. Allen Hynek in the 1970s. So they were still around in Chicago 5 years ago. And I contacted Mark Rodiger. He invited me to stop by and to take a look at their archives, and I did. And that became the first of a whole series of visits. There was so much fun stuff in the archives at Mark's house that I just kept going back over and over again to just look through files and look for fun UFO documents and books and things. Finally, on one of those visits, Mark just kind of casually mentioned, "Hey, we've always been looking for someone to write the definitive account of Dr. Hynek's career." And I said, please, I would love to do that. So that's how it all started. I was in the right place at the right time. Mark just made this comment that day and I just jumped on it. So that was the start of this long, long, crazy ride. And it's been fantastic.
Wow. Yes. I think I mentioned to you the other day that I was looking for interviews with Hynek. And I actually was watching one with Tom Snyder, talk show host, and that was great. So I'm still in touch with I actually knew Tom. He was a neighbor when I lived out in California, and he passed away. I met him just before he passed away, about a year ahead. And great guy. He loved Dan Aykroyd's imitation. Him and Dan actually were friends. Dan Aykroyd used to do an imitation on Saturday Night Live of Tom Snyder as the talk host for anyone. This goes way back into the early 80s, I believe. Anyway, so I talked to Tom's his widow, Pam Burke, who's a producer. She was a producer of his show as well. And she said that J. Allen Hynek was one of their very, very favorite guests. They loved him.
Yeah. Wow.
They said he was really funny, and he was so interesting and brilliant, and they just loved having him on the show.
Well, I've watched I don't know if it's the entire interview, but you can see at least portions of it on YouTube, and it is a really fun interview to listen to. You can tell that You can tell that Hynek felt he was talking with someone who respected what he had to say. And so, you know, and so that animated Hynek, you know, more than he might have been, you know, into some other interview. So they had a nice energy together for sure.
Yeah. Now, the thing I think is the most fascinating part about Hynek is the switchover. You know, he was the guy to debunk, and then all of a sudden it's like, hey, there's really something to this, and then totally dives into it. What do you know in your research about him as, say, from childhood on, if he had a fascination with, say, science fiction or anything like that? Did you uncover any of that?
Yeah, there's definitely some of that in his background. He was born in 1910 as Halley's Comet was appearing in the sky. So he was born under the comet, which seemed to have some influence on his life. When he was about 8 years old, he came down with scarlet fever, and he was bedridden for many, many days. And his mother just went through every book in the house and then started borrowing books from neighbors so that she could keep her son occupied. And so she read some of the books to him. He read some of the books himself. But one of those books was an astronomy textbook. Mm. So from the research I did, that was that moment when he was sick in bed at age 8 was his first real contact with the scientific world. And apparently he fell in love with astronomy. He fell in love with the stars while reading that book when he was 8 years old. He also had interests in writing. He was a pretty good writer in his high school days. He was a regular contributor to his high school's literary magazine. He wrote some really fun short stories.
Ah, wow. Isn't it funny how like a turn in life can just change everything? You know, and a lot of times you do hear about it is a sickness that changes someone's life and gets them interested in things that just turn. Before I forget this, Shane in the chat room, and welcome back, Shane, I should say welcome back me in the regular time slot, is Shane wanted to know if the image on the book was an actual unexplained UFO. What are any story on that?
That is art that was created by the HarperCollins graphic artist.
Okay.
I mean it's clear that they looked at a lot of vintage UFO pictures, because they really captured that look and that style of those kinds of images, like the Rex Heflin photos, for example. But yeah, I believe that was completely created by their art department.
Well, you could have lied. You had your chance. Made up a sighting.
yeah, sorry. Mythbuster.
Yeah.
Well, skepticism is the theme of the
show here, right? A little bit, yeah. All right, so hi, Nick. We're going back. This is many years ago. So he was contacted first by the Air Force at what point, and how was he standing as an astronomer at that time? Why did they reach out to him?
He had virtually no standing as an astronomer. Actually, he was teaching at the Ohio State University and Ohio Wesleyan University. And I think at this point he may have been an associate professor, not a big wheel in the world of science or astronomy or academia at all. He was just, you know, he was a young professor kind of making his way, in the world. But he had spent some time during World War II engaged in some, high security work for the U.S. government, working on what was called the proximity fuse. The first smart weapon was developed during World War II. It was a radio device that you could put in the nose of a warhead, and it would send out radio waves ahead of it as it was flying through the air, and it could be programmed to detonate when the return time of those bounced off radio waves would return to the fuse. It could tell how close it was to the target, and it could set the warhead off at a certain distance. So, as you can imagine, this made things a lot safer for our gunners. They didn't always have to hit a bullseye every time, and so a lot more lived as a result of that. So Hynek had high security clearance because he had worked on this project. So here you've got the poor exit, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, in Dayton, Ohio. So they're right down the road from Columbus, where the universities are, where Hynek's teaching. And they are starting to get, in late 1947, early 1948, they are starting to get buried in UFO reports. Ever since Kenneth Arnold had seen his string of flying saucers mm-hmm. flying through the Cascade Mountains in June of 1947, UFOs were on everybody's mind, and the Air Force was getting deluged with dozens and dozens and dozens of strange UFO reports from around the country. Well, they were doing their best to explain away, to debunk these reports as misidentifications of perfectly ordinary things, airplanes, balloons, birds, astronomical objects. So, and they were pretty good at explaining those sightings away, but they needed a credible, no-nonsense scientific spokesperson to back them up on this. So Hynek was teaching at a university literally right up the road, and he already had some top secret government security clearance. So he was a guy who could be put to work on this project with a minimum of red tape. So the Air Force guys paid Hynek a visit at Ohio State one day and said, "Say, have you ever heard of these flying saucers?" And Hynek had heard of them, and he thought they were kind of a joke. He thought they were embarrassing. And he thought they were a fad. He believed that this was a fad that would die out in no time. But they asked him if he would sign on as a consultant to look over these UFO reports and let them know which of these reports he could write off as simply a misidentification of an astronomical body or an astronomical occurrence. So that was his job on what was then called Project Sign. He was very good at it, and he actually kind of enjoyed debunking all these UFO reports, because, as I said, he thought it was a fad, and I think he thought that by debunking the Air Force's reports, he could hasten the demise of this fad, which was very much anti-science as far as he was concerned.
Wow. Well, we have some questions coming in on the chat room. Someone wanted to know if he ever had any view on Roswell. Now, I know Roswell wasn't made much of at the time, basically. You know, it was like a two-day event and swept under the rug, basically.
Yeah, you're right. At the time, it really was inconsequential. I'll tell you a little background on that for your questioner. When I was researching the book, I could not find anything for the longest time that Hynek ever said or wrote or thought about the Roswell story or about any saucer crash story, because, of course, there are many saucer crash stories, not just the Roswell story. So I was having a hard time finding anything, and at one point I was talking with Mark Rodiger, again, the scientific director of the Hynek Center for UFO Studies, and I said, when I get to Roswell, I don't think I'm going to really have much to say about it in this book. And Mark said, well, you know what? You don't really need to say anything about Roswell in the book. He said it was really not a factor in Hynek's career or in his thinking at all. And I thought it would be a mistake to not mention Roswell at all. That would be kind of hard to do in a book that is focusing on the history of UFOs. So there is a short segment in the book about Roswell, but Hynek made it very clear in several interviews that he was extremely uncomfortable with saucer crash stories. And the big, big reason for that was, if you start talking about a flying saucer crash landing and leaving behind a debris field, leaving behind wreckage, then what you're actually saying is that object was a physical, manufactured object. And Hynek was absolutely not into that idea at all, that nuts and bolts theory. Hynek stayed as far away from that as he possibly could. So Hynek did a really good job of keeping his hands clean where Roswell was concerned. And again, that applies to pretty much every saucer crash story. Hynek just didn't want to have anything.
And that goes all the way to the end of his life? He felt that way?
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah, he did.
Now, had he ever had a sighting himself?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked that. Because I have to tell you, Martin, I kind of laugh at myself now, but I was almost completely done writing the book before that question even occurred to me. And I thought, wait a minute, well, I need to find out if Hynek ever saw any UFOs himself. And it turns out he had. He had had two different UFO sightings. I can't remember the dates offhand, but he had seen a UFO out of the window of a commercial airliner one time on, I believe, was a night flight. And he did take some pictures of it, but as is so often the case with UFO pictures taken at the spur of the moment, you can't really tell a whole lot from the image on the film. So he saw the UFO from the airplane, and then years later, he was at his family's vacation cottage in Ontario, Canada, which is a very remote location, cabin built on a lake in the deep north woods of Ontario. And he saw something one day over the lake that where his cabin was built. And he had no phone at the cabin, so there wasn't really a whole lot he could do about it. They were very, very isolated. But when he had a chance, he did contact someone at the Canadian Air Force or Air Ministry. I'm not sure what they call it. And he gave them the details of his sighting, the date, the time, the latitude and longitude, and said, did anybody else report this? And he came up empty-handed. There were no other reports that he was ever able to find. So he saw two UFOs, but they were both seen very far away, so he couldn't count them as close encounters. So there was no real wow factor to his UFO sightings.
I'll say wow too.
But he confessed, and I quote him in the book that he was rather disappointed. He felt rather left out.
How about that?
That he hadn't had a close encounter.
Well, Blue Sky asked that question in the chat room. I thought that was a good question to ask. He was such an interesting man, and he also came up, for the person that doesn't know this, he's the one that came up with the term of the different encounters, close encounters of the first kind, second kind, third kind, fourth kind. Right. And is that something he actually coined? Do you know how that came about?
It was part of a long process with him. He actually started to think in terms of categorizing UFO events in the late 1960s when the Condon Committee at the University of Colorado had essentially taken over all UFO research for the U.S. government during the time that they were in existence. And during that time, Hynek wrote, he actually wrote an article that appeared in Playboy magazine in 1967. And in that article, he started formulating his ideas for classifying UFO events that he was hoping that the Colorado committee people would adopt. He thought maybe somebody on the committee would read Playboy and see his ideas there. So at that early stage, his idea was simply to isolate cases that had a high strangeness factor, which means anything that doesn't really comport with the known laws of nature and physics, and also cases that had a high credibility factor for the witnesses, which basically, goes into the witnesses' social standing, their state of mind, their education, all those factors. So Hynek was referring to isolate these cases, strangeness factor, with high credibility witnesses, and start looking for patterns among those sightings. That might be a way into at least starting to understand the UFO phenomenon. Well, the Condon Committee did not adopt those ideas in the end, but Hynek kept going with his thinking, and eventually he sort of expanded things to a system that he really first wrote about in his 1972 book, The UFO Experience, which everyone should read. It's a great, great book. And he had actually two systems of three categories each. The first one was general categorizations of UFO sightings that would include, number one, daylight disks, number two, meandering nocturnal lights, and number three, visual radar sightings. He was most interested in the visual radar sightings because he felt that those had the most scientific value. So on top of those three categories, then he went a step further and developed the three close encounter categories. And close encounter number one was visual contact with the UFO within about 500 yards. He thought that was close enough so that the witness could make out physical details, size, she outlined things of that nature. Close encounter number two involved physical evidence. So in this case, a CE2K would involve a UFO leaving behind, say, landing pad imprints or scorched grass where a UFO was seen to have landed. Possibly some physical effects among the witnesses, you know, retinal burns or sunburns or things like that. All of those things have been reported. Or one of my favorites, making cars stall out and their headlights go dead. So close encounter of the third kind, the big one, involves, of course, UFO occupants, entities that are associated with the UFO and either come out of the UFO or are seen close to the UFO. And in those cases, of course, the witnesses, sometimes they merely see these entities from a distance. Sometimes they actually interact with the entities. So you've got those six categories, and of course they overlapped. Something that began as a simple daylight disc could come within 500 yards of you and suddenly become a close encounter case. So that's how Hynek systematized, I think that's a word, that's how Hynek organized his thinking, and because he just believed that, you know, as with all scientific data, if you can categorize it and start seeing patterns, that is the best way to start to understand the phenomenon.
Yeah. Did he, as far as you know, did he ever think that he was going to be alive long enough to find out what was going on, like we all do?
I love that question. I think he was like a lot of us. Yes. I think he, starting out, I think he really believed that it would be possible for us to solve the mystery, to answer all the questions we have about what these objects are. I think later in life, you know, his hopes dimmed a little. There's a lot in my book about that, when he ended up leaving Chicago and moving to Arizona, when he thought that he had financial backing to form a really world-class UFO research center in Scottsdale. And then that fell by the wayside for a lot of complicated reasons. Towards the end, I think Hynek kind of lost faith that we would ever understand the problem. But here's the interesting twist to that. I also think, just from my readings of his final interviews and his final talks with friends and his final writings, I think that he was actually okay with that. I think he actually was starting to think that, as I say in the book, some mysteries are meant to be savored and not necessarily solved. I think he reached a point where he was okay with not knowing, as long as we kept trying to find out what it was.
I think that's all we can all hope for. You know, I mean, I don't have any. It goes back to, I watched a documentary, an early UFO documentary that was somewhere in like the 60s, and there was an older guy in that, and he was saying, you know, I think we'll find out in my lifetime. And he said that, and I'm thinking, this guy's long gone. So it kind of made me think about the whole topic in that way and think, hey, you know, I'll probably never know. It is interesting to explore the topic. That's why I love, you know, doing this show. We have a question in the forum for you from Carrie, and that question is, as Alan Hynek was an astronomer, how did his peers in astronomy regard him with his UFO research, especially when his opinion changed about his belief in UFOs in later years?
A very loaded question. That's a complicated one. Hynek's relations with his fellow scientists were sometimes very troubled, sometimes very, very negative. He didn't always make a whole lot of friends in the scientific community. And, of course, you know, some immediate names pop up. Donald Menzel, who was one of the directors of the Harvard Observatory. He was an astronomy superstar, and he hated UFOs and everything to do with them. So he was a thorn in Hynek's side for many, many years. Dr. James McDonald at the University of Arizona became a UFO believer and just visited Hynek once and just pounded on his desk and said, "Damn it, Alan, why have you been sitting on all this good data and not sharing it with the rest of the world?" So he had issues with fellow astronomers, but then on the flip side, sometimes he had some very surprising allies in the scientific world. When he got into the late 60s, early 70s, after he had stopped working for the Air Force, when he could sort of become, he could become more flexible and actually more free in how he studied the UFO phenomenon. Once he was disengaged, he actually started to gather around him this loose association, and they ended up they college. This loose association of scientists and some pretty heavy hitters in the world of science and academia who were willing to do a phenomenon. It doesn't mean that they believed this, that, or the other thing about the UFO phenomenon, but it meant that they were they agreed with Hynek that this subject was interesting enough and had a level of reality to it that made it worthy of serious scientific study. So for every scientist who Hynek had a really bad, horrible relationship, there was another scientist who kind of believed in what Hynek was doing and wanted to join forces with mm-hmm. him. So that's kind of a very heartening part of the story, that there was always somebody listening to Hynek, even when he thought nobody was listening to him.
Talking with Stan Friedman a while ago, he mentioned that Donald Menzel actually had a CIA connection. It was uncovered, you know, he had a high security clearance. And so that's kind of a mystery, you know, why he was so adamant against the UFO topic.
Well, especially since Donald Menzel had actually seen a UFO.
Really?
as had James McDonald. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah, Donald Menzel, I could probably write a book about him. He's kind of a mystery man. There are a lot of parts to that guy's story that really don't seem to fit together very
well. Wow, interesting. Your next book. You heard it all here, folks. Yeah. You know, we're having a little bit of a Skype.
I have a couple ideas.
Oh, well, are you serious? So go ahead and talk about it if you would.
Oh, I was just going to say I have a couple of ideas, but we're still so devolved in promoting this book and sure. spreading yeah. the word that I'm not close to starting work on a second book, but I have some ideas percolating, and they're not all UFO related.
Okay,
so I'll be honest
no
about
problem.
That.
Hey, can you turn off the camera on your Skype? We're having some Skype issues, and I'm hoping that will solve it. You know, perhaps okay. yeah, just that's perfect.
Okay.
It's right there. That's fine. So we'll go this okay. way a while and see if it doesn't sound any better, then you can turn your camera back on, but we'll go this way for now. So okay. let me just see if we have any questions up in chat. There's probably some. I'll have to scroll back. Now, when you were doing this research for the book, what was I guess what I'd like to ask you is what was some of the things you uncovered that you had no idea about Hynek? Was there anything like that you just said, wow, this is really interesting?
Oh, yeah, there were a number of moments like that. One of the first was, I've already told you the story of how I would visit the Kufos archives mm-hmm. in Chicago and dig into their files and their bookshelves. So when I started officially working on the book, that was where I spent a lot of my time. Eventually, I started to visit the archives across town in Evanston, Illinois, at the Northwestern University Library. Hynek had taught astronomy, had been chairman of the astronomy department for many years. He had taught there for almost a quarter of a century, very, very long and happy career there. And Northwestern has a huge, huge collection of Hynek's work papers and correspondence and news clippings and all sorts of treasures. So the one of the first big surprises for me was what an amazing career as an astronomer he had had. And I discovered all of that at Northwestern University. And then later on at the University of Chicago, which is where Hynek had gone to college and gotten his PhD in astronomy. They also had a huge, wonderful collection of Hynek's papers from the very early years of his career. So between the U of Chicago archives of his early years and then the Northwestern archives of his later years, I developed this amazing picture of truly was a pioneer in the field of celestial imaging. I mentioned in the book at least once that really, without Hynek, I don't think we would have had all the orbital telescopes we now have, including the Kepler telescope, which is spotting all these exoplanets. Hynek was a direct inspiration for that kind of technology. He was quite an amazing guy. He never saw himself as a superstar scientist and never really wanted to be one, but he had some pretty impressive contributions to science, to astronomy. So that was kind of the first big thing. The second big surprise was that he had this really interesting spiritual side. He wasn't a religious guy at all. His son Paul told me, he said, we never had any religion in our house. We were very atypical in that regard. But in his young years in high school and college, he had read a lot of writings of the Rosicrucians and a spiritual leader named Rudolf Steiner. And Hynek was really, really interested in the topics that they talked about, and those included, you know, making contact with the afterlife. Rudolf Steiner wrote about something he called the supersensible realm, which is really a fancy name for a parallel dimension that he thought existed alongside ours and that we could enter anytime we wanted to if we could train ourselves to. Those were the kinds of ideas that Hynek loved reading about as he was growing up. And then later in life, when he was, last year of his life or so, when he was, after he'd been diagnosed with brain cancer and he was in his last months of his life, he returned to that spiritual side of things again. So that was the second big surprise. So you've got this guy who, for me at the outset of this project, he was purely one-dimensional. He was this UFO guru. Well, it turns out, no, he was the UFO guy, he was the astronomy guy, and then he was this spiritual guy too. Really fascinating. Wow,
amazing. Yeah, that is something. And who knows, he might be right with the dimensions. You never know. There's still a lot of speculation of that as far as what we're seeing in UFOs and other things.
Absolutely. And Hynek had a really great term for it. He called it metaterrestrial. He was never a real big backer of the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Huh. But he was fascinated by the metaterrestrial hypothesis.
Wow. Well, another question that came up, and I think I know a little bit of this anyway. Do you know if J. Allen Hynek had any collaboration with Ray Stanford over the Socorro case? I know that he was there, and but I don't know much more about it than, you know, he did show up, and he was there, and Ray met him there and all that.
Yeah, I did have a talk with Ray at one point, and Ray was kind enough to send me his book.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The Socorro Saucer in the Pentagon Pantry, I think that's the title. And yeah, he was absolutely on site. He was one of the first people on site at Socorro, and he was either Hynek or very close, very nearby Hynek, when Hynek was there investigating the event. The impression I get from Hynek's take, and there's quite a bit of documentation on the Socorro case, but the impression I get just from the Project Blue Book file and from material that I found in Hynek's archives was that he was playing his cards pretty close to his vest. I think he sensed immediately, even before he arrived in New Mexico, I think Hynek was already thinking that this case could be, it was a physical trace case. It was a case that involved a craft that apparently left behind landing pad imprints and had burned some shrubs in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Those were Hynek's favorite cases. So I think that Hynek kept a lot of what he was thinking and seeing from Mr. Stanford. That's the impression I get. I don't really have any ironclad, you know, documentation for that. But it wasn't just Mr. Stanford. My impression is that Hynek kept a lot of what he was thinking about Socorro to himself until he could really figure it out, because it really was, you know, it was kind of a bombshell case. The witness was amazingly reliable and credible. It's a traffic cop who, you know,
right.
Didn't smoke, didn't drink, you know, a very, very credible witness, a close encounter of the third kind, The object was sighted very close up. There were occupants involved. It was a huge case. So, yeah, I think Hynek just kind of, like I said, close to his vest during that case because there was a lot going on, and I think he wanted to be very, very careful about how he shared information.
Yeah. Are you able to hear me? Okay.
Yes, I am.
So, having a bit of. Can you tell on your side? I don't want to take up too much time in this, but are you having some internet issues on your side that you're aware of?
No, everything looks good on my end.
All right. So,
I have had internet troubles over the past few days, though. So there may be a problem on my end.
Okay. I may have to have.
Everything looks great right now.
All right, because you're fading in and out quite a bit, and I may have to switch to calling you on the phone if it keeps up, and in that case, I would like for you to type in Skype a message. Just type me your phone number, and I'll give your buzz back. So I'll let you know as we go along here.
Sure.
And so the case that someone asked this real early on in the chat. The case that changed Dr. Hynek's mind from being someone that was to debunk UFOs to someone that, hey, there's really something to this. How did all that happen?
It didn't happen all at once. I think that's a common misconception that people have, is that there was some kind of eureka moment when Hynek just suddenly saw the world differently and he completely changed his mind to UFOs. It was really a gradual sum, and it began surprisingly as early as 1952, back when this was all still very, very new. You got to remember the Kenneth Arnold sighting had taken place in the summer of 1947. So 1952, 5 years into this, Hynek is starting to sort of waver. As I mentioned earlier, when he first started out with this, he thought it was a fad. He thought it would die out very quickly. He kind of made fun of it and made fun of the people who had spotted the UFOs. But after 5 years, the Air Force calls him back and says, hey, Hynek had left their employ for a couple of years. So he comes back in 1952 and he realizes, hey, not only has this fad not burned itself out, but there's a remarkable consistency here. If he went back over the previous 5 years of UFO reports that the Air Force had amassed, there was a very clear 20% residue of cases that nobody could explain. Hynek couldn't explain them. The Air Force couldn't explain them. They just sort of hung there, defying explanation and puzzling. And so when Hynek saw that consistent pattern of 20% year after year, that's when he started to think, okay, maybe there's something that I need to be paying attention to here. Maybe I should start looking at things differently. So that was the start of the process. It honestly did, that process wasn't really complete until 1446 in Michigan at the famous, fabulous swamp gas case, mm-hmm. the Dexter Hillsdale in southern Michigan. So it was really a 14-year process from Hynek first starting to sort of have some doubts about what he was doing until he, finally reached a point where he decided, okay, you know what? I'm going to fool around anymore. I'm not going to carry water for the Air Force anymore. I'm going to start approaching this as a scientific problem.
Wow, interesting. Do you know if he ever had a chance to meet Betty and Barney Hill?
Yes, he did. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, that was such a busy time because so Barney and Betty Hill's UFO abduction took place in 1961. But by the time the Hills had gone through all the physical maladies, all their psychological issues resulting from that sighting, which they could not remember, by the time they ended up going under time regression hypnosis to remember what had happened to them in the two missing hours of their honeymoon trip. We're getting into 1964, 1965. This is right around the time of the Socorro case that we were just discussing, the Socorro, New Mexico case. There are some really high profile, really remarkable, unexplainable UFO cases going on that have really captivated the American public in the mid 1960s. So Hynek ends up meeting Barney and Betty Hill in that later time frame. I can't remember exactly, 64, 65, at the behest of John Fuller, who had just written, you know, two of the hands down UFO books ever, Incident at Exeter and The Interrupted mm-hmm. Journey. Now, Interrupted Journey was all about Barney and Betty's abduction. So Fuller invites Dr. Hynek to have dinner with him and Dr. Benjamin Simon, who had performed the time regression hypnosis, and Barney and Betty Hill are there too. So Hynek's at this amazing dinner party with John Fuller, Benjamin Simon, Barney Hill, Betty Hill, and the Hills agree to go under hypnosis while Dr. Hynek is there.
That's it for the free part of the show. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with a Venezuelan UFO researcher, and his name is Tiago Luis Tiquiti. And so check back next week. And remember, you can support the show for $2 or more per month. That information's on Podcast UFO. Thanks so much, and we'll be back next week. Keep your eyes to the sky.